You're listening to Studies in the Book of James. If you'd like more resources like this, or you're in the Kansas City area and would like to connect, you can find us at thebridgekc.church.
For those of you that are walking the Christian walk, you know that there are some things that are we allow room for interpretation on, and there are other things that are pretty cut and dry. There are some things that we have room for personal conviction and other things that we really want to get right. Because if we start off with a wrong understanding of what we're doing, we get way off base as we go. Have you ever heard the phrase, close enough for government work? If you work for the government, I'm sorry. It's a joke, but it's talking about the fact that sometimes in government work, there is a lot of room for toleration of how things get done. In some cases, though, it's not true at all. I was reading recently about the U.S. Air Force testing their windshields of their fighter jets because they were concerned that if they flew through a flock of birds, one of the windshields might break. You don't want a windshield cracking at 500 miles an hour. And they weren't really sure how they were going to test for this. You know, they could just go out and fly through a flock of birds, but if you do that, then if it doesn't work, you're in bad off. And the optics of flying through a flock of birds at 500 miles an hour just does not make for good press. So they came up with an idea, and they built a pneumatic gun that would fire the carcass of a chicken 500 miles an hour. They can do it on the ground, and they park their jet on the ground, and they point the pneumatic gun at the airplane, and they press the button, and the chicken flies, and boom, and the windshield holds, and they're, oh, okay, this is going to work pretty well. We're excited about this. Well, the Royal Air Force in Britain heard about this, and they were terribly intrigued because they thought our jets are very similar, but they might be a little different. We should probably test the same thing too. So they ordered one of the pneumatic guns. They bring it. They set it up. They load the chicken. They press the button. The chicken goes directly through the windshield, directly through the seat where the pilot would be sitting, and embeds itself in the bulkhead behind the pilot's seat. Couldn't figure out what they'd done. They checked the rivets, they checked the thickness of the glass, they checked everything they could, and at the last minute they look at the pneumatic gun, and on the side of the gun there's a warning sticker that says, warning, thaw chicken. Some things you just want to get right. You can't afford to mess with them because there's a certain way to do it. And if you're putting your faith in Jesus, you want to make sure that you get that faith right, because the ramifications of getting it wrong are intense. Now, I'm not talking about quantity of faith. Some of you are saying, well, the Bible says I just need faith of mustard seed. I'm not talking about quantity. I'm talking about constitution of faith. Not how much, not how loud, not how boisterous, but the nature of your faith itself. You can find faith in people, it'll discourage you eventually. You can find faith in a system, the system will fail. We're looking at the latter part of James as he talks about what a saving faith is like. Faith that will carry you through trials, faith that will draw your neighbors to Jesus, and faith that will present you on that day in front of him, and he will respond to you, well done, good and faithful servant. He doesn't even say well believed. He doesn't even say well attended. He says well done. What is he talking about? If that's not the faith we're pursuing, a faith of victory and a faith of statement to our neighbors and a faith that catches his eye, we are going through a lot of religious contortions for nothing. There are easier ways to get donuts and coffee than what we're doing. Getting faith right from the beginning means the difference from life and death. So in James, we're going to look at chapter 2, verses 14 through the end of the chapter, and talk about that idea of what a saving faith is like. And James starts writing here by asking two big questions. Let me read James 2, 14. We'll go from there. What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? Here he describes a version of faith that is apparently not the faith that we're instructed to live out. It is a faith without works. What is he talking about? He explains it a little bit more in subsequent verses. But before we get there, let's look at the two questions that he asked. He's talking about a faith that is just a mental assent, or maybe even it's heartfelt. It's two out of the three, but it doesn't work its way out to our actions. He's talking about a faith that finds no empathy for others in need and sacrifices nothing of our own personal wants on behalf of that faith. It is faith, it's heartfelt, but it's undemonstrated. And his first question he asks is, what good is it? Like, what good is this faith that does not have accompanying works? How many of you know the name Rich Mullins? If you're 40s and up, you'll probably remember this guy. Rich Mullins was a phenomenal songwriter. Lived in Kansas for a while, actually attended Friends University in Wichita for a season. He saw a lot of success early in his career as he wrote for Amy Grant and Michael W. Smith, saw a lot of radio play. Most of his own songs for himself were longer, they were more poetic, they were a little more intricate, and a little truer than maybe we were used to hearing. Mullins was eccentric. He had the habit of going days and even weeks refusing to put his shoes on no matter what meeting he went to. What are you going to do with a guitar player who won't wear shoes? A friend of mine saw Mullins in concert one time, and my friend was sitting in the front row and was intrigued with him as he sang and he spoke and he sang and he spoke, and it went on and on and on. My friend didn't realize this. He's so intrigued. Finally, Mullins stands up from the piano and says, "I guess when everybody goes home, the meeting is over." And my friend looked at his wife. His wife was sound asleep, and he stood up and turned around, and the entire place had left. Everyone was gone. Mullins was a little bugged by the American Christianity industry, and as the royalties piled up from his songs, he finally told his accountant, "Figure out what the average income is for an American. Pay me at the end of the year that amount and just give the rest away." Near the end of his life, he moved from Nashville to a Navajo Indian reservation where he taught music to little kids, and nobody who knew Rich Mullins personally found that to be unusual. That's just who he was. Amy Grant called him the uneasy conscience of Christian music. And regarding this passage and the question of what good is the idea of faith without works, Mullins wrote this in a song. "It's about as useless as a screen door on a submarine. Faith without works, baby, it just ain't happening. One is your left hand and one is your right. It'll take two strong arms to hold on tight." Faith without works fails to pass the purpose test. When James asks what good is it, he's asking a legitimate question. It might be ornamental, it might be a trinket, it might be romantic in the sense that it reminds you of your childhood, but if it doesn't do anything, what good is it? I read yesterday on Twitter, somebody mentioned that faith without works is like decaffeinated coffee. Why? Why would you do that? Do you really have room in your life for one more thing that does nothing? Like a screen door in a submarine, it's a little ridiculous, even if we thought it was a good idea at the time. And sometimes I hear people say, you know, as I get a little older, I get disillusioned with my faith, or I got bored. The reason people grow disillusioned with their faith is they come to the realization it's not good for anything. Like the faith they're living isn't actually doing anything. And they become disillusioned not with the Lord, but with the way they've been expressing their own faith. It's not accomplishing what they'd hoped. And as a pastor who's supposed to encourage people, sometimes I have to admit, yeah, you're right. What you have there is useless. The faith you're living there is really not accomplishing anything. James said it. Rich Mullins said it. I'm just agreeing with them. Faith without works is good for nothing. No wonder you're bored. People come, "Why am I bored, Pastor?" We're not bored as much as we are boring. As we try and live a life of faith with no way to express it or no way to demonstrate it to others. The reason it's not good for anything is it's missing the component that James is talking about, works of compassion and involvement out of our faith. You aren't disillusioned with your faith. You're bored because of the lack of expression of faith in your life. And even you can't tell the difference between your life and the life of your neighbor who has no faith. You know, this summer, Kelsey and I have been married 30 years. And we have been tired, broke, blessed, stressed, everything in between in 30 years. But early on, we made this commitment that if the Lord asked us, we'd say yes. If the Lord asked us to give something, we'd say yes. The Lord asked us to do something, we've said yes. And for all of the things we have not been bored. I don't remember sitting around going, I don't know. What do you want to do? I mean, it's just, it's not been a part of our life. Not that we've got everything right, but that idea of living out our faith, it's, you know, it's been hard. We've been tired. We've not been bored. I would pick tired over bored any day, because bored leads to death. James asks a second question in that first verse about faith without works. He asks, first of all, is it good for anything? Then he kind of asks it a different way. He says, can that faith save us? That faith. What is he talking about, that faith? Can faith that does not have accompanying works that point to Jesus actually save our souls? It's not debating how we are saved. It's talking about what it looks like if we are saved. It's very different. Here's where the big fans of Paul the Apostle get riled up. Because Paul writes in Ephesians 2, 8 and 9, for by grace you have been saved through faith. And this is not your own doing, it is the gift of God. It is not a result of works, so that any man would boast. So Paul says, you're not saved by works. And James says, well, hey, if you don't have works, can that faith save you? Martin Luther got so bent out of shape of this frustration between the two that he actually did not like the book of James. Martin Luther would put the book of James in the back of the Bible. I'm not kidding. Put it towards the back, because he didn't want to put it anywhere near Paul. And he actually called the book of James a right strawy epistle. By the way, that picture was taken at Olin Mills. A right strawy epistle. What was he referring to when he called it strawy? He was referring to 1 Corinthians 3, where Paul says, now if anyone builds on a foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, he looked at James and said, I think it's made out of straw. Didn't like it. Is James really an epistle of straw built on a less worthy foundation than the epistles of Paul? No, in fact, James is complimenting Paul's writing. He's agreeing with Paul, because the same Paul that says you're only saved by faith, your works don't save you, the same Paul wrote to Titus in chapter 3, verse 8, the saying is trustworthy, and I want you to insist on these things so that you who have believed in God may be careful to devote themselves to good works. These things are excellent and profitable for people. Paul himself thought that works were a part of having a true faith. That's why James says, can that faith, can faith that does not show itself obvious through our works save us? Paul would have said, faith that saves demonstrates itself in works. He's not saying salvation, the peace that you find with God, comes through working for it. He's saying that if you find peace with God, there will be demonstrations of that in your life. So as Paul develops this thought, he makes another point here. The point is that real faith sees and meets real needs. Real faith sees and meets real needs. In other words, it's not just theoretical, and it's not just by association. It's not just, well, we're a part of this church family, and the church family, you know, I don't know, but I know we do some good things over there, and by association, I'm doing the things that I think I should be doing. No, we don't just think about it, and we don't just claim to have faith that does works because we know other people who do that. Real faith sees and meets real needs. And this is how James describes that. Chapter 2, verses 15 to 17. If a brother or a sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warm and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. Now, there is something about hypothetical or statistical situations that allows us to disassociate from it, right? If we see statistics, we don't think of it as real. If we see faces and names, it's more real to us. My son recently left working for a large missions organization that was seeing people saved around the world every day. But he said, Dad, I want to serve on a church staff somewhere because I'm seeing spreadsheets. I want to see faces. I've got to see faces. I know it's real, but I have to see faces because it's easy for me to disassociate with numbers. When we think of the poor or the disadvantaged, we talk about them in vague terms because it's easier to distance ourselves from need when it's just a number. But what James is talking about here is not hypothetical for the people that are reading this. This isn't a spreadsheet or even a stranger beside the road. James calls them to meet the needy's needs within their body, knowing that the churches he was writing to contained a lot of people who struggled with poverty. And he said, don't fall into the trap of saying, be warm and well-fed, or the euphemism of, oh, the Lord will take care of you. Yes, the Lord will take care of you, but he might use me. He might use you. Some folks think, well, in Scripture, you know, the Lord just did it. He provided manna and he did all of these things. And he still could do it, but in a New Testament setting, far more often than not, he deputizes his believers to do the things that he wants done. And in Luke, Jesus is teaching those who follow him, and he tells them the most profitable thing they could do is empty themselves on behalf of the needs of others. Luke 12, 32 to 34. Fear not, little flock. For it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to the needy. Provide yourself with money bags that do not grow old, with a treasure in heaven that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart also be. So treasure, he just told them to give everything away. He just told them to serve the poor. He goes, yeah, you do that, you will be rich. What is Jesus teaching us here? That real faith, saving faith, has an effect on the heart of a man or a woman that turns their priorities upside down. It loosens their fist on the things of earth, and it encourages them to do good works that serve other people. That's what real faith demonstrated looks like. And he actually does us a favor by giving us the opportunity to demonstrate our faith by works, which makes it real in our own heart. Faith without works. He says, can that even save us? Is that even real? Then he tells us that real faith meets real need. And then he goes on to discuss this false dichotomy between belief and action, because the world would tell you those are two very different things and they don't ever have to touch. He tells us in James 2:18, but some will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. I love the first couple verses of that, first couple words of that. But some will say, someone will say, if you're in any position of authority, if you're a CEO, if you're a manager, if you're a mother of toddlers, you will understand what I'm about to say. No matter how minimal you make the expectations of performance or behavior or cooperation, there will be someone who will attempt to find a loophole to make the task easier. And that's what they're doing here. Some will say, and James is ready for that some who will say, you have faith and I have works. You talk about God, I do what God is doing. You hold to a faith code, I hold to the code of get or done. I don't need both sides. In fact, I'm suggesting that your faith is not equal to my works. And James closes that loophole and he tells them that faith and works are indivisible. Those two things go together. This is what it says about us when we try and divide faith from works. It tells us that we are negating the efforts of the people who did works that we might know Jesus. It means what they did didn't matter. If we try and divide faith from works, it tells us we are trying to achieve justification without involvement, and that we are observers of what God is doing, we're not participants. If we try and divide faith from works, it tells us that we are looking for the minimum that we can do for a man who died for us. If you're exploring Jesus this morning, you kind of wandered in here and you're like, I'm not even fully sold that Jesus is who he is. Let me encourage you, if you're exploring Jesus, explore serving at the same time. Because it puts you in a framework for what real Christianity is. Don't get sucked into the lie that you can receive without pouring out. There is a word for that. It's called the Dead Sea. James makes one more point about the idea of belief and faith and how those two work together. In James 2:19, he says, you believe that God is one, you do well. In other words, you've got the theology right. You believe the right things. Congratulations, even demons believe and they shudder. You can believe the right things and operate in the demonic. You can have good theology and act in a way that is completely contrary to it. When your faith is a saving faith, there are works that accompany it that make it obvious what is important in your life. And nobody has to wonder, are they a believer? Being a believer is the only explanation for your behavior. That is a faith that will save. So as he closes out this passage, James does what he does. He gets very practical. And instead of making his point one more time, he gives us two pictures of what it means to walk out our faith. And I'm going to just hit these very, very briefly. First picture he gives us is Abraham's faith towards action. James 2, 20 to 23. Do you want to be shown, you foolish person, that faith apart from works is useless? Was not Abraham, our father, justified by works when he offered up his son Isaac on the altar? You see that faith was active along with his works, and faith was completed by his works. And the scripture was fulfilled that says Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness, and he was called a friend of God. Here, James says that Abraham's actions of putting Isaac on the altar, being willing to sacrifice his son, those actions completed his faith. He wasn't saying that Abraham was righteous because of that act. In fact, he refers back to a scripture in Genesis 15:6. It says he believed in the Lord and it was counted to him as righteousness. That was 15 to 20 years before he laid Isaac on the altar. So he was counted as righteous at that point. What he is saying seven chapters later when he lays him on the altar is that that action completed his faith. It made it concrete, his willingness to do that. You say, why would that have done that? Because it showed he had faith in God that was more intense and deeper than he had faith in what he assumed to be the answer to his issues. What did he have faith in? What was the promise? The promise was that he would be a father of many. There would be a nation that would spring from him. But he had no children. Then he has Isaac, and in his mind, this is my answer. This is how it's going to be. I've got my answer now. And when God asks him to lay Isaac on the altar, the question is, do you have more faith in the answer or do you have more faith in the promise? Some of you struggle because you think you see how God is going to turn this out, and you've got a death grip on an answer that you think is the one God has for you. And you've got more faith in that answer than you do in the promise that God gave you. Let me just kick the can 30 years down the road for some of you. You have no idea how God is going to fulfill the promises of your life. Don't hold tight to what you think the answer is. Hold tight to the promise. Holding tight to the promise to the point of obedience will complete your faith. Because there will be times in life you go, I don't know if this answer is actually going to work. I mean, you think about it. Isaac at some point was a teenager. Abraham had to look at him going, are you serious? This is the answer. Ultimately, it was the answer, but the promise is what he had his faith in, and this completed his promise. He talks about one more person in this passage before we wrap up. He talks about Rahab, how Rahab's act displayed faith. James 2, 24 and 25. You see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone. And in the same way was not also Rahab the prostitute justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way. Now you've heard the phrase, three strikes, you're out. Rahab enters the storyline of God with two strikes, at least. She is a Gentile and she's a prostitute. In a Jewish mind and culturally, she's already got two strikes against her when she comes into the game. Let's refresh our memory on the story here a little bit. In Joshua 2, Joshua sends two spies into the city of Jericho. And as they're going from house to house and slinking around like spies do, they find themselves in a house that is built into the exterior wall of the city, top floor. They find themselves in this house, and oh, by the way, it belongs to a prostitute. So here they are hiding out. And the king of Jericho somehow gets an idea that they're there. He actually sends people to knock on the door to challenge the prostitute, send the spies out. But she might be a Gentile prostitute, but she sees the hand of God turning the pages of history. And she has some sort of insight about what's going on here. Your station in life does not matter if you can see what God is doing in the hour. And so she tells the spies, with the pressure of the king at her door, I know that God has given you this land. And she describes the talk among the townsfolk about the unusual favor of this God on the Jewish people. And she's talking herself into a profession of faith there, talking about the power of God in their life. And in Joshua 2, 11 and 12, as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted. She's describing what they're hearing about God helping them conquer the other cities. And there was no spirit left in any man because of you, for the Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. It's a confession of faith. Now then, please swear to me that by the Lord, as I have dealt kindly with you, you will also deal kindly with my father's house and give me a sure sign. And so the arrangement they make with her is their life for hers. That if you have faith in God, you help us escape, and when the day comes, your life will be spared. Why did James use these two extreme examples? A man who had to lay his son on the altar and a prostitute who had to help spies sneak out of her own city. He was driving home the point that anyone's faith, no matter who they are in the Bible or in the day that we live in, has got to be backed up by works or it doesn't last. That last, at the very end there, his claim to faith and to reject backing it up with our behavior is to lay claim to something that James calls dead. James 2:26, for as the body, apart from the spirit, is dead, so also faith, apart from works, is dead. We are not interested in replicating a dead faith. It won't save anybody. A faith that is alive will always express itself. He says, show me your works, not so we can celebrate the good that you're doing, but so that we can celebrate what God is doing in us. God, in his graciousness, actually models this to us. Isaiah 53, 4 and 5 talks about the works of Jesus on the cross and what he did for us. It says, surely he has borne our griefs and he has carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed.
Thanks for listening to this episode of our 14-part series on the book of James. If you're in the Kansas City area, we would love to meet you. Check us out at thebridgekc.church.